All right, let's begin. And so welcome, everyone, after a big 4th of July day. My name is Michael Pellett, and I'm a pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I also teach in the philosophy department at St. Thomas More College, which is the Catholic college on the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon. And this week, my theme is a short history of grace. Basically, something very foolish, and I probably should have never done it. But what I'm going to try to do is, over the expanse of history, beginning with the Hebrew peoples in the Hebrew scriptures, and then the New Testament, and then Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther, and liberation theology, look at the different ways our understanding of grace has been formulated, worked out, practiced, brought forward within the church. And again, these are five different ways that grace is still at work and operative in the church, in the various traditions and the various faiths. So we'll be looking at that. And originally, I was going to do theologies of liberation last, but since it's 4th of July and we've got that theme of liberation and freedom and everything like that, we thought we would do this one first. And so we'll be looking at these liberation theologies, which is the newest way, if you will, of trying to talk about and understand grace. The term liberation theology is formulated in the late 60s in Latin America, but it is a term that has been picked up throughout Latin America and Africa, Asia, African American, or sometimes known as black theology. It's womanist theology, feminist theology, other ethnic theologies. There's a gay theology, lesbian theology, so on and so forth. And now even theologies of liberation are taking on ethical or ecological issues. So it covers a vast spectrum. And of course, tonight in 55 minutes, we will look at everything in great detail. We'll look at some of the general tenets of these theologies of liberation, particularly to see where they differ from what would be different understandings of grace that you'll begin to see some of those if you come to sessions later this week. The first basic claim of theologies of liberation is asking the question, where is God in a history flowing with massive public suffering, oppression, and victims? Where is God in history? And one would think, well, that's an easy question, but it's not. And the reason for that is that for most of the history of the church and our understanding, we've kind of bifurcated or divided history into just plain old history, if you will, and we'll put that on this line, and perhaps you've heard this term before, salvation history. And we'll put that here in this line. And the way this kind of works is that it's kind of what I call the blitzkrieg theory of history, because what we're doing here is God is up here with salvation history, and then, if you will, bam, bombs down in here, and we've got, let's say, Noah and then back up here, and then boom, Abraham and Sarah, boom, Isaac, boom, David, boom, Isaiah the prophet, then boom, Jesus, and you know, on and on it keeps going, right? But of course, right, salvation history then is saying, where is God at work in history? Well, he's at work here with Noah and whoever I name, Moses and the Exodus and David and Isaiah and here and Jesus. And so what these theologians of liberation ask to say, yeah, but what about all these little spaces in between? Isn't God the God of all history? Can we really divide history into, if you will, almost a secular history where it seems God really isn't involved much, and a salvation history where, of course, God is involved with Moses, David, Jesus, Paul, all those folks, right? And so, therefore, in our own contemporary situation where we are at, the question arises, well, are you a part of salvation history, or are you just dull, boring, old, can-be-ignored history? Who are you? Any takers? Right? You know where you want to be, but you see, right, you got a real problem here, don't you? In that sense of trying to find out where you belong in it. And so the first thing that these theologies of liberation understand and want us to understand is that we must get rid of this model and understanding of history. And that all of history is God's history. And all of history is graced, such that God is at work not only among the Israelites, but also with the Egyptians and the Moabites and the Hittites and the Jebusites and all those other ites. And that as well, in Jesus, of course, God is at work in Jesus, but God is also at work in all of the history that's going on at the time of Jesus, at the time of the New Testament, and of course in our time. And that is good news because, again, that continues to bring forward that whole notion of God as Emmanuel, right? God with us. And it's from this understanding, right, that they come up with their basic tenet, God is on the side of the poor or the least, right? Those who are the outcast, those who are the victimized, those who are the oppressed, those who are the marginalized, those who are the powerless. Why? Because of this understanding of history. Now, this does not mean to say God likes the poor best or God likes the least best. But it wants to bring the poor and the least into God's understanding of grace. Because you see, again, the kind of claim that is so often made by the victors is that obviously if you win, if you are in power, God is on your side. And if you lose, and if you're powerless, and if you're poor, obviously God isn't on your side. We see this kind of thing coming through, for example, within the United States. We'll use them in your great heritage. with the Puritans. And that whole understanding about how, right, if you are prosperous, then of course you are blessed. And the reason they made that claim is because they had a notion of what they called double predestination. God already from eternity determines that some are destined for heaven, and God from eternity destines or predestines that some are destined for hell. And so that, if you will, quite frankly, and I'm not making a lot of fun of this, it's basically an understanding that God has gone through from eternity and basically gone, save, 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 damn, save, save, damn, 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 save, damn, save, damn. And since God's will is immutable and unchangeable, of course, some are saved and some are damned. And if you are damned, why would God be so stupid as to give the damned prosperity? Because it's not going to do them any good anyway. So, get rid of it. And obviously, therefore, we come to that understanding that if you are poor, if you are the least, if you are sick, you must be one of the sinful and obviously not blessed by God. God is not on your side, and a God is not, again, part of your history. Out of this develops things like manifest destiny. Right? Because after all, it was the God-fearing, prosperous believers, as they push west, that are going to continue to prosper and take over the land and everything, because after all, that's your manifest destiny. And, you know, all the other heathens and whatnot, get rid of them, because God didn't pick them. So you see how this works. And of course, this kind of thinking is not just within thinking here within the United States, but it happens all over. One of the most important cases in history where this happened is with the Emperor Charles V. And do any of you good Lutherans know what happened in front of Charles V?
Augsburg Confession.
June 25th, 1530 is the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, where the Lutheran princes and the Protestants, as they were known at that time, basically those in terms of Luther and company in Wittenberg, present their theological position to Charles V. And of course, he wasn't convinced, right? And so we know that happened, what happens there theologically. But the other thing that happens at the Diet of Augsburg, because again, remember, diets like this, when they're called together, don't just last for a day or two. There was all sorts of things on the agenda, and actually the dealing with all those uppity Germans over there in Wittenberg and Saxony was kind of low on the scale. The big agenda item was the debate going on between Juan Ginez de Sepulveda, of whom they have named a boulevard in Los Angeles, and Bartolome de las Casas. And maybe you've heard of Bartolome. The big issue there is the argument was whether or not the indigenous peoples of the New World have a soul, which means whether or not the indigenous peoples of the New World are human. Juan Ginez de la Pulveda says no, the indigenous peoples have no soul, therefore not human, Therefore, we can treat them like beasts. So to put them down there in the silver mines, the gold mines, the plantations, and treat them more harshly than you would treat a horse, because after all, we know a horse is really something valuable, while these people aren't. I mean, you know, they're less than a dime a dozen. It's okay. Bartolomé de las Casas is the one who provides the argument that indeed these people have souls and they are as fully and totally human as anyone in Europe, and therefore should fall under God's love and care. Guess who won? Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda. The indigenous peoples do not have a soul. They are not human. And so therefore, again, of course, if that's the case, right, there's no need for God to be with them in history. They're not even human. And so you see, we have this whole understanding now, and first and foremost, what theologies of liberation are going to address is this terrible, terrible error, to put it mildly, throughout the traditions within the New World that, you know, most of the people of the world are outside of God's grace because they're not even human. And this is saying God, as the God of all of history, is also your God, is a gracious God, who welcomes you in, who cares, loves, and forgives you as God does everyone else. And so therefore, the Christian faith now in these theologies of liberation sees as some of its primary tasks to transform oppressive social structures, institutionalized violences, and victims who are suffering under fatalistic attitudes. Liberation is more than technocratic or economic development. Right. And so again, in our world today, you can talk about development and globalization and all of that. And the critique of those kinds of movements is that it can still be dominating. And therefore, theologies of liberation do look and say, yes, indeed, sometimes appropriate technologies and some economic development, if undertaken properly, are helpful and useful, but that's not enough. Liberation, if you will, must go deeper, must be more expansive. In other words, people are more than producers and consumers. One of the favorite texts that theologians of liberation like to look at is Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25. And I'll read that for you, and you'll be able to see, I think, very easily why they like it. Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25. And it reads as follows. For I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating. For I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and delight in my people. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it, or the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, right? Mortality rate, infant mortality rate, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime.
For one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth, and one who falls short of 100 will be considered accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord and their descendants as well. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, but the serpent, its food shall be dust. They shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord. So if you pick up in there some of those phrases, liberation, blessing, God with us, and how they interpret this understanding now of the people to be them and all of them in this situation. This is where grace now becomes good news for the poor. And so again, to phrase it kind of in this way, it's a theology of the oppressed for the oppressed in solidarity with the oppressed. It is going to address the economic, social, and political structures which are dehumanizing, which leave people with no freedom and no future. Liberation theology is this-worldly rather than otherworldly. And it's not that they are denying heaven or anything like that, but they're saying heaven's not the problem. Heaven really isn't why God is important. God's important, grace is important for our lives here and now. Heaven's taken care of. Heaven's a done deal. You won't have to worry about anything then. It's now where things are happening and going on, right? Again, in history. And so the question is, right, what is God doing now? Because after all, if God at work in our lives, if Christ crucified and risen is no good for us right now, what's he good for? In other words, we need Christ now. We don't need him after we die or whatever. This is the place of the gospel. Here and now, in this world, in history. And so therefore their theology is, if you will, a very pastoral theology, trying to think about what the grace of God means right now for all of us in our lives. And so, of course, this then raises the question of, you'll have to answer this, what has the church been doing all this time that this hasn't happened?
It was for a couple of generations.
Okay. Which were those generations?
Well, I think about Stephen and the Acts story. That's okay. Going to be part of it.
So you think right there in that New Testament period, the church was doing this.
And I'd have some confidence that that probably continued for a couple hundred years.
Okay.
We take a long time to remember good things, though.
Some liberation theologians would agree with you and say, yes, and you know that you're precisely on target to say we take a long time to remember those things. And why? They say, because those are dangerous memories. Because the church, as we heard this morning in the Bible study, right, the church was more kind of countercultural. I mean, again, to claim Jesus is Lord is a traitorous statement, right? People got crucified for saying that. But why else hasn't this been happening in the church?
It wasn't for a long time, wasn't that was done. There's a political aspect of the church in terms of making kind of making sure that the poor felt like they were destined to be poor, and that was their sort of their lot in life, and that they weren't, you know, to keep them from revolting against the, you know, the gentry and the nobility.
Okay, so you think in different periods of history the church was at work to keep the poor poor, and they were really on the side of the powerful, the elite, the ruling class.
I'm not an expert, but...
No, we're just talking to say why, you know, kind of... Why has the church for many, many centuries failed basic liberation 101?
There were times when the church was involved very much in the politics and power on earth at the time, and that put them in league with the other people that had power. I mean, there was a time when popes marched armies around and conducted wars. So they certainly weren't tied up with caring for the poor because they were extending power from the Vatican out and actually taking territory and so forth. So that they got a little preoccupied with things here on earth in that way.
I think that God has often risen when you least expect her to, in people you don't expect to come, and rarely out of the power of the church.
Okay, and why is that? What's the matter with the power of the church?
It's invested in power. And I think that is that's a biblical story. I mean, it when you look at the Bible, God rarely comes when you think God's going to come, and in the way you think God's going to come from the Old Testament, the New Testament, it's just wackadoodle. I mean, really? Really? It's going to be a baby. It's going to be the kid against the giant. And I think in history, it happens the same way. I mean, in our history. Why? That's how God does things, I think.
So that basically when God has been working among us and has come among us, God has not come to us through the church?
Often.
Often. More than 50% of the time? It's just so much.
Well, no, she said through the power of the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, that word.
Okay. And we do hear, and to show that too, right, we need to make a differentiation here between, right, the institution that we call church, like when you talked about papacy and all of that, mounting armies or whatever, and church that we understand in our biblical sense, right? I mean, one example of church, where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst of them. I mean, where that happens, they probably don't have a constitution and, you know, advancement office and all sorts of stuff, right? I mean, here again, we're talking church where the gospel is preached and sacraments are administered, if you want to give the thumbnail Lutheran definition of church. But again, right, that's... That's different from the institution like the ELCA or the Presbyterian Church in the USA and everything. And not saying that the institutions are totally evil or anything, but here again is where you get that issue of power that often gets you into trouble, and of course where the poor, the victims, whoever, are neglected
Michael,
and ostracized.
It's the acronyms. It's the acronyms.
It's the acronym. Shame on you. Yes, please.
We say three creeds in the course of the year, and one of them a whole lot. And it strikes me that they were formulated around what people didn't agree about in the first centuries of the church. And that's what we repeat and repeat and repeat. And the whole, in the middle of the creeds, is the life of Jesus. It is really a whole, because all the death stuff only matters because of his life. But they probably more or less agreed that his life was significant, so we don't formulate it and repeat it. So what we repeat is the stuff that we've even forgotten that we ever fought about. And we don't say a statement of beliefs that comes out of the center, which is what his life was like.
Or even with the church, just again, two examples. The first is that, since you brought it up, I thought of the Nicene Creed, where again we believe in one holy Catholic Apostolic Church. Now, note the thing there is that's not a statement of fact. That's a statement of faith, because it's the kind of thing, if you look around at all the acronyms, ELCA, PCUSA, and on and on and on, to, well, we don't believe in any of those institutions. We believe in one holy Catholic Apostolic Church, and we believe that it's God's Spirit that's going to call, gather, enlighten, pull all those folks together. And that's a statement of faith, because often as we look around at our institutions, you go, ay, 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 where's the church? Secondly, Luther's great hymn, right? A mighty fortress is our God. Didn't say a mighty fortress is our church, right? Or our community, or our congregation, or our pastors, or whatever you want to pick. It's God. And we sometimes forget that. We always think kind of like fortress church. There's the problem again. Aaron, did you have your hand?
I was just going to go back to the why has liberation theology not, been present earlier or whatever. And it occurs to me that even today, in order for the church to survive, if we think of it in those terms, it has to preach things that people can at least deal with. And this idea of liberation theology, of like a preferential option for the poor, totally disrupts the social order. And why would something like that be popular? And if someone preached that, you know what I'm saying? Like, they don't have a church anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're absolutely right, but on that last, you don't have a church anymore, you say no. That one is yes and no. The church you probably have now is an institution you're not going to have anymore, but you're going to have a whole new and different way of being church, right? That would be theologians of liberation claim. Right. We're going to be doing church differently. And there, let me get on to that and try to pick that up. And I will go back to one of the first folks within Latin America who began to formulate some of this stuff. Well, I think it's just one T. Gustavo Gutierrez. And he talks about how we need to understand grace and sin And faith, or no, let me put that in a different term here. Liberation on what he calls, and this is his phrase, three mutually interpenetrating levels. Oh, now isn't that impressive? So now when you go home from Holden, you know, you're in the family, and you say, well, how is Holden? You can, in a very erudite manner, say, well, you know, I've learned about the three interpenetrating levels of grace. Pretty impressive. What are they? And kind of going, he would say, from the surface to deeper levels. There is the social, economic, political level. The second level is the notion of intersubjectivity. And the third level is the level of faith. Now, at what he also says, again, in the history of the church, is that by and large, we've paid attention to this third level. But this is also the most abstract and conceptual level. And sometimes we'll sneak into intersubjectivity, and sometimes we'll come up here to the social, economic, political. But often we're going to bracket these off because, after all, right, the church has no business in politics. Right? Got to stay out of that. And of course, you know, the church may be out of faith in terms of the social level. You know, you should be charitable and contribute generously to, you know, the United Way and a charity of your choice. But other than that, we're not gonna mess around in any of these levels. Again, if grace is thoroughly immersed within history and what's going on, grace is at work in all three of these levels. But of course, so is sin. Yes?
Can I ask what you mean by intersubjectivity?
I will explain that in a moment.
Okay, good.
So, and so is sin. So what's going on here? Well, again, at this level, we've got faith and sin, and this is all of our talk where we can use language like justification or salvation and all of that kind of stuff. At the intersubjective level, this is how we deal with one another. This is the level of freedom. This is the level, he says, where we are talking about humanization, where we see all people as human beings, fully, truly, completely human beings. Why? Because they have freedom. What does it mean to have freedom? To have freedom is not merely choice. Choice is linked with power and desire and doesn't give you any freedom at all. Freedom is linked with possibility and with the future. Why is slavery so despicable and so dehumanizing? Even if you are treated by the best master in the world. Because as a slave, you have no possibilities. You have no future. Once a slave, always a slave. And so too your posterity. They too will always be slaves, no matter how nice the system may be. And of course, if you have no possibility, if you have no future, you are not truly and fully human. Because after all, what we hope for in the future determines who we are today. I mean, think about that. Why would any of you have done so many of the things you've done? Right? Why would you have gone to university unless you would have thought somehow that would advance your station in life, either to help you for job or career or learning something new and interesting and making you a better person? And of course, every class you enrolled in at university, you hoped to pass. Because if you didn't think you were going to pass the class, if there were no possibility in future you'd ever pass the course, you wouldn't have enrolled in it, would it? That would have been just stupid. And so again, right, what happens in oppressive situations at this level is where we take away people's freedom and therefore their possibilities, their future, their humanity. This level, social, economic, political level, this is the level of power. And of course, this is the realm of justice and the realm of peace. And you probably have understandings of justice and peace. But let me give you the definition, working definition of power and what power entails. Again, Gutierrez, quote, "Power is the capacity of an individual or group to modify the conduct of other individuals or groups in the manner which he or they desire, and to prevent the power wielder's own conduct from being modified in a way not desired." Okay, did you catch that? Should I try one more time? Power is the capacity of an individual or group to modify the conduct of other individuals or groups in the manner which he or they desire, and to prevent the power wielder's own conduct from being modified in a way not desired. So in other words, power is somehow I have the force and capacity to wield this power over you to get what I want and what I desire, and also such that what you want and what you desire is not going to modify my desires. Right? So it's domination. And here, theologians of liberation will go back to a nice little aphorism of Augustine in the City of God, where he defines sin as how we have been dominated by the lust to dominate. We are dominated by the lust, that desire to dominate. Such that, again, that sense, even if I wanted to break it, I couldn't. I mean, that's the, if you will, the Paul, that's how Augustine interprets the Pauline language of the power of sin. The power of sin is such that I want to control you guys. And I'm doing a pretty good job of it. You're all sitting there pretty nice and content, and no one's thrown any books at me yet, so power's going good, right? But we're all dominated by that. That's the issue. And of course, you can see how that sense of power and domination has been carried out socially, economically, politically. In terms of intersubjectivity, you can see how that works in communities and institutions, right? In the church, in the government, wherever you want to go. And of course, how that works in terms of sin, where we even try to get our power such that we think we can dominate and control God to fit into our ways and our desires. And again, with lots of time, we could talk about these things all week long to see the dynamics here. But of course, what happens again is the power of grace, right, is such that it shatters that kind of power at all three of these levels, right? And then here again are the positive sides of that, so that God's grace at this level will work justice and peace. At this level works humanization. At this level, through faith, works justification, salvation, reconciliation, those terms for that, and that's what's going on. Okay? So far, so good. You with me? Okay? Comments, questions? All right. We're going to make one more move. And that is, and this is our kind of 4th of July theme, freedom must be redeemed by grace. Right. At first you'd think, well, you know, given all of this has happened, we've got freedom, now that's good, we're all okay. But nope, not good enough yet. Right? Freedom has to be redeemed by grace. Right. And again, that kind of sense of why does that have to happen? Right? And what's going on here such that that might not be happening? Because the claim is there is even some modest sense of freedom at work even in our sinful selves. In other words, in activating freedom, every person brings suffering upon others and upon one's own self. It's kind of, right, we're enslaved, again, to use Paul's language, that in trying on our own to obtain our freedom, it's always at the expense of others and maybe even at the expense of ourselves. This is because, again, we think about freedom in this way, that somehow freedom means we are autonomous. A word that literally means self-governed. It's the Enlightenment ideal of what it is to be human. Right? To govern yourself. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I am, right? This is what we see in our realm as the whole phenomenon of individualization, right? The almighty individual seeking our freedom, and so on and so forth. But that's problematic, according to these folks. That again, right? What we are looking for here is not simply a life that is free from suffering or servitude, but a life that voluntarily takes on suffering as an action. A life that freely serves. It is in service that freedom is realized. So that true freedom, full freedom, happens in terms of service. That sense, and I want to refer you to, if you were in the Bible study this morning, or even if you weren't, to some of those passages that we looked at
in Galatians chapter 5, which is precisely the passage these theologians of liberation will look at too. Galatians chapter 5, verse 1 and verses 13 to 15. Again, just to get to some of the real nuts and bolts here. Here's what Paul says to the Galatians. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. To verse 13. For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence. Mm-hmm. Right? Freedom for an opportunity of self-indulgence. Right? Autonomous, self-governed individualization, right? Cultural narcissism, the me generation, all of that stuff can come in here to put it into our context, right? That's still a sinful way of using freedom. Grace needs to redeem us from that. So how do grace and freedom come together? Paul continues in verse 13. But through love, become slaves to one another. Right? There again, you've got that terrifically paradoxical language, which this theology will use too, right? Liberation theology means we become slaves to one another through love. And how could we do that except empowered by God's grace? Right? Of which, again, we see that happening in Christ and Christ's cross. Paul continues, verse 14. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. If, however, you bite and devour one another, take care that you are not consumed by one another. Right? Again, that notion, if you use your freedom for your own autonomy, you're going to be, again, having to wield power. And wielding that power means you bite and consume, right? I mean, the very literal understanding of we are a consumer society. And we literally consume each other as well as consuming our resources. So you can see how ecology is starting to say, you know, this liberation theology is some pretty good stuff. We're talking about consumption here. That's the issue. In other words, again, freedom is service, but this liberation is always tested by the cross. Christ frees freedom to a willingness to suffer and die. Until then, one is always in one form or another, in some degree, a victim. Like Christ, through the Spirit, we are recreated as suffering servants. Suffering here is not a penalty or undeserved affliction. It is action freely undertaken and offered in creative, liberating, transformative ways for the self and for others. Liberation is the transformation from victim to servant, empowered by the grace from the cross, where God no longer is judge and tyrant, but a fellow sufferer. It is the promise that God's reign throughout the world is one of compassionate love. The grace of liberation comes through being embraced through those arms stretched out on the cross in compassionate love. So again, right, what the grace of God does And again, this seems to be somewhat counterintuitive. But this is how it works. Grace transforms us at all three of those levels. From victim to servant. And of course, right, we are God's servants here and now in history. This is again how the grace of God enters our history, our communities, our lives, as we are all servants of this gracious and compassionate God. So that's really, really quick overview of liberation and their dynamics and understanding of grace. Little time for questions, comments. I'm sure for some of you this is old hat. For others, this might be the first time you've heard it. Just impressions. Yes, please. Or were you just
scratching my arm?
Okay. Anyone?
Sometimes at church, I have acquaintances who would want to command what I do. How can I say this? And I think I am your servant in Christ, not your slave. And that's a fine line sometimes. Mm-hmm. To go from victim to servant, what's the difference and where? Because I feel it immediately that they want me to slavishly do what they want, and then I come up and say, no, I'm your servant in Christ,
right,
not your slave.
The difference there is in this notion of freedom. That's why this becomes so important. When through grace you are liberated to be free, to be servant,
right,
it's not under someone else's power who has taken away your possibility and your future and your humanity. Right? Nobody is constraining you to be this servant. Right? You are freely, out of faith and love due to the grace of God,
servant.
That's where you, and again, right, that's not an easy thing to figure out all the time. That's where we got to work together in community to try to understand, right, are we victims or servants in certain situations? But that's how one would try to figure that out. Yes, please, back in the corner. You had your hand up? No. Anyone? Yes.
I just wondered, is there a line, sometimes a very foggy line between being a servant of others and letting yourself be taken advantage of?
Yeah, I think we've quite frankly probably have to face that decision daily.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's the whole challenge and struggle of a faithful life of discipleship. And I don't think there's a clear-cut answer for that. I mean, that's a question where, again, I'm going to put my feet firmly in midair. Because that's the only position I can take on that question. But that's constant struggle, and that's what makes it such a good question and tough question. Anyone else?
I've been thinking about other world religions, even though they're not based on Christ and salvation, etc. I wonder if they don't somewhat have a same worldview, or are there some religions who may take on the cause of the poor, like liberation theology?
Yes, again, if we have this view of history, right, we come up with that understanding then that all history is grace. And that somehow, in some way, the graciousness of God is also going to be there in other peoples and in their cultures and societies and communities. And we might not particularly know or understand how, but we could not, I mean, if we deny that it's there, then we're back in that salvation history, other history model, and we don't want to go there. At the same time, we recognize too, just like us, if that history is grace, that history is also under sin, and so all those other religions and their institutions can also be as victimizing and oppressing as the church has been at times. So, but we certainly would not, if you will, deny that God's grace is at work everywhere in history. Yes, please.
Can you do a little diagram of talking about those victimizers that we have the sense this is so strongly an important theology in Central and South America? How about for us in North America, where when we find ourselves more often victimizers than victims?
Yes, I think that would be certainly from the Southern Hemisphere. The criticism of the Northern Hemisphere is you guys are usually the oppressors. And I mean, I think there, right, we've got to come to grips with that, which again is not a very comfortable thing to do.
But so then, to hear this as a theology that's important for us to, I mean, where is our spot in it going forward? Where is God's grace in the stop being oppressors?
Well, I think God's grace is there in it has been shown to us how we have been engaged, if you will, in victimizing so many, but now it is God at work among us to, through grace, turn us into servants. And so therefore it is now the opportunity and the call for us to be a servant church and to move ahead. You had a hand, please.
I was just wondering, is there an argument against this?
Oh, yes.
It seems like it's so obvious, but explain that.
Okay. Well, the key place where you could go is about, what is it about? 12 or 13 years ago, then Cardinal Ratzinger, who was in charge of the Congregation for Doctrine, came out with a document against liberation theology and all its problematics. And to put it in a thumbnail, his basic objection to it is that it was just simply Marxism. It was communism. And as you can see, and if you were at the session at 4:15 with Julio on socialism, and thankfully he took all the tough questions there. I mean, the thing is, yes, at this social, political, economic level, theologians of liberation often use Marxist social, historical, economic analysis because it actually works quite well, right? But you see, that doesn't necessarily make them Marxist because after all, throughout the church, theologians have always used, if you will, other philosophers in ways of doing things. The key comeback to that kind of answer is, well, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas used Aristotle, and you're not calling him a heretic and Aristotelian and non-believing Christian, so why couldn't these folks use Marx in the same way? Because you see, at these two other levels, Marx is not helpful for them. They're going elsewhere, and of course they're going back to scripture and tradition for their basis there. But that's the one issue, kind of a ad hominem cheap shot argument, oh, you're all Marxists. The other one is that, again, concentrating only on this level in that document, they are accused of reductionism. In other words, this is no longer the Christian faith. This can at best simply be a social moral program. And, you know, that's not bad, but that's not the church. Those are the two quick criticisms there. All right, we're going to have to stop. I mean, if you have other questions or comments, we can certainly talk about it during the week. Come up to me, talk with me about that. But right now, thank you, and you are all liberated.